Welcome to Language Access is No Vitamin, an essential podcast for those shaping the future of healthcare in America. Let's transform our healthcare system from seeing language access as an optional vitamin to the cure of patient-centered care. Welcome to Language Access is No Vitamin. Empecemos. Welcome, welcome to Language Access is No Vitamin. I am your host and founder of Culturized Access, Joanna Tudela, your strategic partner for patient-centered care. Today, we have a special, extra special episode with a guest speaker, Mr. Sean Norris. So Sean is the president of the Florida Registry for Interpreters for the Deaf, coordinator of interpreting services at UF Health St. John's, and Sean has developed an online community, Hello Interpreters, for interpreters and translators, alongside with roles in the Certification Commission for Healthcare Interpreters and the Safe AI Task Force. He enjoys family, reading, and football amidst his professional endeavors. So let's all welcome Mr. Sean Norris for today's episode.
Hey,
hi, Sean.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. When we talk about language access, really, there's so many things to cover. And although, you know, I know a little bit about everything, I always like to bring somebody who's an expert in something very specific. So in your case, you know, we're going to be talking about ASL, the deaf and hard hearing community, and also the ADA, which a lot of people, you know, tend to forget that it's also some of the regulations that not only affect healthcare organizations, but any other organization within the U.S. So we'll cover a little bit about all of this. But before, I would like to learn a little bit more about you. You know, how did you get into the interpreting world, specifically in the ASL world, and how, you know, Hello Interpreters came along?
Awesome. Well, thank you. So as far as in sign language itself, both my parents are deaf. So that was our language that we spoke in our household, and it was very common for us to use that. I learned English a little later when I went to school. So I remember going to like ESOL classes and things like that. Because I had a bit of an accent where I sounded like a deaf person, they kind of thought I was hard of hearing, but my hearing was fine. I just had to learn how to talk more appropriately for my peer group. And as far as interpreting, I grew up interpreting for my parents, like many people who have families that speak languages other than English. And for me, I relate a lot to that. But I did not want to be an interpreter growing up. I wanted to do anything but interpreting because I just was like, I do this for my family all the time. Why would I want to go get paid to do it for other people as well? You know, someone kind of pulled me into doing a couple of work jobs for them. And when I started, I actually really enjoyed it. It was a real profession. It was unique to me. I got to go to different places and learn different things and kind of be a support to those that are deaf and hard of hearing in different areas in their professional lives, their personal lives, and especially in their healthcare as well. I very much enjoyed it. I started in educational interpreting, and I had a really great boss who kind of helped mentor me and take me under his wings a little bit and get me started in this industry in a more firm footing. And I just really just haven't left it since.
I love your story because a lot of us, you know, that end up being interpreters, for some reason, it's related to, you know, a personal experience. Either you know, parents, in my case, I was an LEP, a limited English proficient, when I got to the U.S. So, you know, I'm doing it back, you know, to my community and things like that. But you are making a point that is very real. And it's that a lot of kids, you know, that have parents that somehow are limited English proficient or in the case, you know, deaf, they end up being, you know, the interpreters for the family. Yeah. And we talk a lot about how we don't want to use children as interpreters, but it's really the reality of a lot of kids in this country. So yeah. what was your experience, you know, having this responsibility, you know, to take over all your parents' businesses, really? It's just, you know, anything outside of the house, it has to basically go through you as a child. And now as an interpreter and someone that promotes not using kids, how do you, you know, how do you see this, you know, still happening in the U.S.?
Thank you. It breaks my heart when I see kids being used as interpreters still. And I always talk to people, especially in healthcare, and remind them that it's illegal. We cannot do that. And then I just say, would you really want to traumatize a child to be in such an adult situation? Because like in healthcare, we're usually using them in probably in more acute care settings, like an emergency room. And that's not ideal for a child. They shouldn't be seeing stuff like that. For me growing up, and I'm sure for you and many others, they can relate to that experience going to the with their parents to their doctor's appointments and interpreting for them. Or like my dad had his own business, so I remember interpreting some of his phone calls for him or going with him to certain appointments to talk to different business people. As a kid, you don't really, I didn't feel like it was anything unusual because you don't really realize that. But when I started getting a little bit older and being around other children my age who didn't have deaf parents or didn't have to interpret for them, I could tell that we were different. We didn't have the same mindset, I felt like. And I think it's just because those of us who had to interpret for our parents were exposed to adult situations from a very early age, and it kind of forces you to grow up a little bit quicker. If you saw that movie Coda from Apple TV, I felt like that was a great portrait of a lot of our lives who grew up doing that. I would say for a lot of children of deaf adults, CODAs, I would say nowadays that's less and less true, that kind of experience, because of all the language access laws. And deaf people are far more adamant of their rights about getting access. And you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act that was enacted in 89, 90. And so we're still within a generation or two of that law being in place. So when deaf people meet other deaf people, they always talk about the ADA. Like it's become part of the culture because they remember a time when they didn't have this law to help protect them. And they had to rely more on family members and friends and children. So they value it, and it becomes more, they become more assertive when they need an interpreter, which is great, because then I've met some CODAs who are younger than me who have not had to interpret for their parents. And I think that's wonderful because that's really how it should be. We should be able to provide services for those parents and allow their kids to be kids.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things, like a lot of, you know, providers, not just in healthcare, but, you know, adults don't really think about what we're pouring the child through, right? Like it can be a very simple things, you know, like, oh, what's your insurance? You know, like, did you do this or not? And that's not that bad. But really when we get to, you know, medical history, you know, conditions, diagnosis, things like that, it can really be daunting. You know, I always tell them, like, would you want to tell your parent that they have cancer? Would you want to ask your parent, you know, how many sexual partners they had? You know, like those are sort of things that kids should not be part of the conversations. And we're putting children to be there and, you know, to be that liaison between the provider and the patient. And it is just really, you know, like you say, it takes away a little bit of their innocence and their childhood. So, you know, it's great. Like the ADA is such a strong, you know, universal in the U.S., you know, law that people are aware of. And I think that's a very good advantage for deaf and hard hearing individuals that, for example, other LEPs don't have, right? Because we have other regulations. We have the Title VI of the Civil Rights and we have things like that, but not one specifically for, you know, these other communities. So I'm happy to see that. And like you say, it's only like one, two generations, but hopefully the future looks much, much better. And we also see representation. Like you say, we have CODA. I remember the first time I saw, you know, a main character being on TV was a show called Switch to Birth. And I was like, wow, I learned so much about that community and that they actually use real deaf people, because that's another thing. A lot of the times they don't. And you can definitely tell nowadays, you're like, okay, this person just more, you know, the three or four signs that they needed to learn to, you know, do the scene versus like, why not bring, you know, actors from, you know, that community and really show. So I think there's been a lot of improvement because, you know, the media is important. I mean, there's shows or movies, things like that, but it's important to see yourself represented. So it's great to see those things.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly, because for me growing up, it was basically just Marley Matlin and maybe a few others you got to see. So it is nice for me to see a lot more deaf representation within our media, because I think about all the kids that are deaf, they get to see themselves there. And I feel like that's just great, because that helps them expand their horizons.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, the deaf and hard hearing community. It's not sure. It's not that big. We're looking at approximately, you know, 1 million people, right? But that's the actual deaf community. But the hard hearing, you know, it keeps increasing, especially, you know, older people that start, you know, losing their hearing and things like that. And I don't call me on this stat, but I think something like by 2060, like 50% of people are going to be somewhat like hard of hearing and things like that. So we're kind of pretty much all going eventually through life. And then it's an increasing problem, right? So let's talk a little bit about how language access interpreting really can, you know, support providers in communicating. Why is it important, you know, to provide specific, you know, interpreters for ASL? Like, meaning, like, why not just, you know, provide like written material? Like, what's so special about, you know, being an ASL interpreter?
It's a great question, and it's one I'm asked a lot, because they're just like, oh, well, you know, they're in America, they can read and write English, right? American Sign Language is just a derivative of English. And it gives me an opportunity to tell them a little bit about the origins of American Sign Language, you know, how it came from France. And it was a mixture of Martha Vineyard Sign Language that was used, Plains Indian Sign Language, and some of the rural sign language. And it was just kind of created. And the grammar and syntax has nothing to do with English at all. So, and for me, like when I've conversed with deaf people in an international setting, I understand the deaf more from like France better than I would the deaf people from England, because they use a different sign language. Whereas our sign language is, we can kind of understand some of the French deaf, and because it's a little bit more similar in structure. And I just, you know, I think that's something I always point out. And then I also point out that in American Sign Language, we don't have a written language. Some have tried, but it has not really stuck. And because of that, I say it's, you know, it's considered like in some other languages where it's an oral tradition. It's not written down. And so some people think, oh, when deaf people write in broken English, they don't have a good education. And I'm like, no, that's not true at all. It's just, if you did that in sign language, it probably would have been perfect grammar, perfect syntax. But in English, it doesn't work because it's a different language. And that's what I try to really drive home to people. And like in providers specifically, I tell them what's one of the most important things. And it's always, well, we got to get the medical history, right? Their history and physical. You got to get those two things done first before you can really do more with the assessment, right? Because those kind of clue you in on what to look for. Well, how do you do that without talking to the patient? How do you do that when, even if they did have a lower education, why would you use written materials back and forth if that was not the most effective means with that particular deaf person? Now, there are some deaf, you know, I would say deaf and hard hearing people are on a spectrum. There's a whole range that you can have different needs. Some are probably a little bit more oral, like you mentioned, those who might be more hard of hearing or late deafened, they don't use American Sign Language. They just kind of read lips, they write notes, they rely on captioning, that kind of thing. And then you have deaf people like more like my parents, where they're using American Sign Language and it has its own culture and meet and values.
I love that you mentioned two things that are very important. First of all, I want to talk about that this is not English. Like, we're not just literally just, you know, saying it with, you know, they're not going to read our lips. Like, it's not, you know, one specific grammar. It's not the same thing, because a lot of people don't know that. they just think that, you know, I'll just speak louder or slower, or, you know, I'll make like my own signs, you know, and it's just not that at all. And it happens a lot, you know, and it's very frustrating, right? Because you're not really providing that service. In my case with Spanish, it's kind of the same thing. Like, oh, we'll just break my broken Spanish and their broken English and we'll communicate. And it's like, no, that's not quality care. That's not, you know, equity. That's not at all anything where you're doing. So it's very similar. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, you know, it's not, you know, English. It's a whole different language. So that's great. And also what you mentioned about family history, you know, that is such an important part of any medical encounter. You know, at least 80% of the information of the diagnosis are going to come from there. And the experience that I have is that a lot of organizations that don't provide quality language services really forget that step, that pre, you know, seeing the provider step. It's like, we'll ignore the interpreter at registration, we'll ignore the vitals, we'll ignore the interpreter, you know, at why you're here. But then when the provider comes, like, here's the interpreter. And it's like, well, that's great, but you're really forgetting all the previous. And medical history is so, so important. So what has been your experience, or what do you work with providers to really make them understand the importance of, you know, the interpreter throughout the whole journey, like going to the lab, getting x-rays, like all of that needs to have interpreters, and a lot of organizations forget about that.
Yeah, it's a great point. And it's one I really try to drive home. Like a lot of times in a clinical setting, they seem to think, well, we only need interpreters for when the doctor's here, or when a specialist is here, or when the nurse needs to do an assessment. But I've pointed out to people, okay, let's just watch and see how many people go in and out of that patient's room in a span of 12 hours. A lot of people go in. You have environmental services, you have food and nutrition, you have speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, any specialist that was assigned, the registered nurse, you also have any techs, patient care techs, who come in and help the patient, and maybe some other visitors, maybe a social worker, care coordinator, a chaplain. And think about all of those people. That was just like, what, a dozen people I just named? And they're going in and out of that room, right? I've been a patient before. I don't know if you have, but even during the night, I couldn't sleep at a hospital because I was constantly being like checked and poked and prodded. And I'm just like, I understand what people are going through now all night when they're being woken up and being asked all these questions and getting blood drawn. And it's kind of frustrating because you just want to be left alone, right? But one thing I always point out to people is, what's the one thing you're supposed to do when you enter a room? You wash your hands. That's a given. You should be doing that. And then when you walk into the room, you're supposed to announce yourself. You're supposed to say, hi, my name is Sean, and I am your nurse for this evening. I'm going to come check on you a little bit. Is there anything you need right now? If we don't have an interpreter for that interaction, that person never has the opportunity to convey anything. There's no relationship being built. That impacts HCAHPS scores. Patient-provider communication goes down. Communication with nurses go down. And, you know, those things have direct impact to reimbursement rates. And it could affect your GPOs as well. I'd imagine, you know, in my experience working with other languages as well, that's a very common thing. They just walk into the room. They don't really say anything because they know they don't speak English. And then they start like messing with their IV or something. It's like, I'm like, what are you doing? You're basically assaulting them. Like, you need to tell them what's going on. You're just touching them. They don't know who you are. You got to tell them.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I interviewed somebody. I was doing one of our, you know, walkthroughs. So we go to organizations and we, you know, do the patient journey to see, you know, where the pitfalls are and things. So I interview one of the lab people and she's like, no, I don't. I'll just go international. I want to take your. It's like, here, they get it. And I'm like, no. I was like, how am I going to even start this conversation? It's like, no, yes, that is international. Yes, they'll know why they're going there, but you still have to do a lot of things. And it really goes into, you know, creating that relationship, building that trust, not just directly provider patient, but, you know, within the organization and the patient, you know, like you're saying, like you just walk in and, you know, I'm switching nurses. I'm just going to write my name in there. I'm not even going to bother telling you anything because I know you don't understand me, or just a simple checking in, you know, all these little things really add. I mean, nobody likes to be in a hospital. Nobody likes to go to clinics. Like, people don't like doing that. That already adds a lot of stress, a lot of trauma for some individuals, in addition to, you know, communities that have a lot of mistrust within the healthcare system. So you're just really adding more and more into this, you know, issue, and it just creates bigger disparities. So I totally see what you're saying about that. And so what are some, you know, recommendations? I have a question for you, because so when we, you know, you're saying it's not a language that's written, and that's not a possibility. So what is your recommendation for providers that need to give patient, you know, handouts and, you know, things like that, like, you know, paper notes, things like that, for whatever reason? Like, what are some best practices when it comes to working with the deaf community?
So I always like to tell providers, if you are slotting yourself 15 to 30 minutes with that patient, double it. Because there's going to be some possible cultural issues, education issues, language issues, social issues. Things are going to be more complex than just needing an interpreter, usually, because there's a reason they're here in an acute care setting, right? They're here because they had a series of events, a series of choices impact them along the way to where now they're in such a bad position. So I always encourage them to be more cognizant of that, the time, allow more time for the visit. Handouts, I always encourage them to read the handouts to them, and I will interpret it. Like, because I can't be alone with the patient. I can't sit there and translate it for them, right? And I always encourage them to use the teach back technique. And we do, we're supposed to be doing that with our patients in general anyway, no matter the language. So, you know, working with them. One thing I always like to point out to providers, and also to interpreters and interns as well, is I'm like, okay, on a regular, I say regular interaction with someone who speaks English, how many times do you have to clarify? And they'll be like, oh, a couple of times. And how much do you actually think they understand? And they're like, oh, it's tough, you know? It's like they have diabetes, but they're still kind of not being compliant. And I don't think they really understand how serious it is. And I'm like, great. Now let's add a language barrier on top of that, right? Now we're really cooking. It's a bigger issue. So if we're having issues with the average, I say, American who speaks English and does not need an interpreter, there's already issues there. We already have poor health scores in our nation. So how much more so with somebody who speaks a different language, right? We have to allow more time and try to find other ways to give them more access.
Absolutely. I love that. Can you tell me a little bit more about cultural issues and, you know, what are some cultural differences within the deaf community that you see with the standard American that providers and, you know, anybody working in healthcare should know about?
Ah, yes. So, you know, again, you know, I'm not going to say all deaf people do this necessarily, just like any other culture. But in general, a lot of my deaf patients would prefer to be very direct. So if a provider's kind of hedging and not really being forthright, that means I have to interpret and match their intent. So I'm also hedging because the doctor's hedging. Then the patient gets kind of confused, and then that's kind of a cultural issue, right? The provider's just not being more direct, and it's okay. But I know in other cultures, being direct is kind of rude. Right, it's more about reading between the lines and not so much saying everything that has to be said explicitly. Another cultural issue is primary care appointments. A lot of times, doctors will go in, they go straight to their computer, and they start talking to you with their head to you, the back of your head, right? And they're just doing this. My patients hate that; they think that is so rude because the person's not looking at them. Because in sign language, obviously, eyesight is very important, right? Having that clear connection between me and the provider. They absolutely hate that. And they also don't like that sometimes some providers are trying to be in and out in 5 minutes, and they're like, oh, well, hold on, I have more questions. And you seem like you just want to leave, and that's not your job. You're supposed to stay here and talk to me more, because time is not as a bigger deal. It's more like, spend time with me, help me understand this more, because the communication is important and it's a value. Whereas the provider's like, I already told you, so now I'm going to go. And it's like, no, 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 stay, stay, stay. So those are some of the cultural issues that I've seen come up within our healthcare setting.
I love what you're saying. So let me see if I got it right, right? So yeah. We're looking at direct communication. So not just like every time you work with an interpreter, you have to use short sentences. You know, you can't just go on jokes, not be using slang, not be using, you know, any of this, you know, comparisons and things like that. So that's a given for all of them. But then in addition to that, we want to be very specific and very, you know, detailed, but direct with what we want, what we need, what we're asking. Eye content is very important. So it's not just about the hands, right? You want to look at the facial expression. A lot of people don't think about that. And the time. And I hear that. I feel like a lot of, you know, immigrant communities are like that too in our countries. Yeah. We spend like most of the time with a provider and we barely see the nurse. We barely know who, you know, who they are. And here's kind of like the opposite. Like you spend more time with your nurse than the doctor is like in and out. And I felt like that for a long time. Like, I actually avoid MDs. I'd rather go to nurse practitioners and PAs because I feel like they have more of that training of, like, care about what I have to say. I always have things to say, you know? Like, I want to feel like you care about me, not just check, 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 I'm out next. So that's very similar. I love that. I'm definitely going to be a post about that. So thank you. All right, so let's move into, you know, the ADA. So... Mm-hmm. What does it mean for a health organization to truly be compliant with the ADA regulations? Like, what are the things that you're like, I see this most of the time, and that means you're not compliant? Like, what will be some of those
things? Yeah. So often I will see organizations maybe only use video remote interpreting. And while that's a great system and it's wonderful, we use it all the time in our healthcare system. Sometimes they over rely on it and they say, oh, it's good enough. But they don't take into effect, maybe the patient has other needs, right? Like with the ADA, it specifies it, a series of items. Like if any one of these items are not compliant, then you're entirely not compliant. You're not providing effective communication. And some of that would be sharply delineated images. It can't freeze, it can't lag, it can't stop, it can't start. Like it has to be flowing very well. And because usually they're on Wi-Fi and it's in a giant building with other equipment, it can kind of cut in and out. So that could be an issue of noncompliance. Also, the interpreters, sometimes they're not always qualified to interpret that particular situation. They're just popping in. They have no idea what's going on. There's no context for them. They're trying to play catch up while they're interpreting. Some of them do a great job, but some of them struggle. Another one would be the providers, so nurses, techs, registration staff. A lot of times they don't even know where the device is, or they don't even know how to turn it on, or there's other issues associated with it. Those are all considered issues of noncompliance. They're because they demonstrate you haven't been trained appropriately. And also another thing to think about is, with deaf people, we're taking the three-dimensional language and making it two-dimensional. So that can kind of complicate some things, especially if they have any vision issues, if there's any cognitive issues, maybe some other disabilities that are involved that we're not aware of. So many things could be involved. Like I always discourage the use of remote interpreting with whether over the phone or video with anyone who has dementia. That disembodied voice is a nightmare for somebody who has dementia or Alzheimer's. That really, it scares them. And, you know, we want to be able to provide that care, that reassurance. So someone like that would probably need an in-person interpreter, ideally for most of their sessions that they need to have interpreting for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I love technology and it helps a lot, but we all prefer, you know, that in-person interpreter because there's so many other things that get lost, especially the phone one. That was like, that's my least favorite. I mean, I understand the useful and I know, you know, it's best than nothing, but well, obviously that doesn't work for ASL, but you know, it's like great, but a lot of organizations are really moving towards that because it's cheaper, but it's really not always the best care that we can provide our patients. Before I ask you, you know, if there's anything else, what about you know, the parents, right? Like a lot of times, you know, we might have the child that's deaf, but the parents are not, or vice versa. You know, the parents are deaf, but the child who is the patient is not. So what are some, you know, suggestions that you have for providers to really understand, you know, the importance that, you know, you can't ignore the child and just speak directly to the patient, to the parents, because you are kind of taking out that autonomy on our own body and our own health. But you also can't ignore the parents who are deaf just because the child speaks English and is not deaf. So what's your experience on that talking to organizations?
Yes. What's interesting is there is another myth that happens within healthcare organizations. Sometimes they think only patients get interpreters. And the ADA doesn't say that. It says anybody coming to your facility, right? So I tell people the equivalent is you build wheelchair ramps and you make things more accessible for people with any mobility issues, right? You don't know who's coming, but it's ready, it's available for them to use, right? You don't say to someone with a mobility issue, oh, if you're not a patient, you can't use this ramp. That's insane. And I was like, it's no different than with interpreting. Like, you can't just say, no, this is only for the patient. No, it's for everybody that comes into your facilities. And so I really try to encourage them, have them involved. Now, especially like if there's deaf parents and the child is hearing, and they are minor, you definitely need to have an interpreter there because they get to decide, right? What if the child doesn't understand what's going on? What if the child hides things from them? I've had cases where I'm interpreting for the family, and it was a teenager, a minor, but the minor was hearing, and I'm interpreting. And once the parents left the room, the minor then began to disclose other things they were doing. They just didn't want their parents to know, right? Just as an example. So that's like crucial information that they would like to have known, right? But they wouldn't have, the patient wouldn't have been disclosed if the parents were there, just as an example. So that's why it's really important to have interpreters available, whether they're remote or on site.
Absolutely. I love that example because it really applies to anybody that needs interpreters. So that's very universal. So is there anything else? What would you like to say to, you know, leadership of healthcare organizations when they're thinking about, you know, why is language access not a vitamin, right? Like that's the title of it. That's really, yeah. A lot of organizations like, it's a nice thing to have. And I'm like, no, it's not. Besides that being the law, it's really going to solve a lot of your pains, from patient safety to budget to you know, staff burnout, everything. So what would you tell providers, especially leadership, why is language access not a vitamin?
You have to make it a big part of your diet if we're going to talk about nutrition, right? It's a necessity. And what I tell people is it needs to be built in, not an afterthought. It needs to be part of the organization, not something you're like, oh, they're deaf, let's go find an interpreter. This is something that should be pre-built in, right? By the year 2050, the majority of the country will be of minority groups. So white people will no longer be the majority in the United States by that time. Well, what does that mean? That means more and more people will be speaking other languages because they're coming from other countries. This is a country built by immigrants, right? And it has that tradition, and people are still coming all the time. With all the conflict around the world, we've seen increases in Spanish. We've seen increases in Ukrainian and Russian, among other languages, Haitian Creole. Anywhere that there's instability in the world, they're coming to America for stability. And in healthcare, we are the safety net. They're coming to us. We all need healthcare at some point in our lives. And so why not have that already built into your system, ready to go? Because all it takes is one lawsuit to just ruin everything for you. And it only takes one mistake. And that's really sad. But if you're proactive, then you can minimize those risks and improve your HCAHPS scores. You can improve your patient satisfaction. You can really improve clinical outcomes, right? And really, really help them. You know, a conservative estimate, you could say 10 to 25, maybe even 30% of your patient population are going to need interpreters.
sign language, Spanish, Portuguese, whichever language you want to insert for your area, they're going to need it. So you might as well just go ahead and have that built in.
Absolutely. And just for those that don't know, the average lawsuit related with health, with communication interpreting in healthcare is $5 million. So that's the average, $5 million. And that doesn't even count, you know, all the PR you're going to have to be doing to fix right. that. So it's really, you know, save those $5 million for one lawsuit and really put it into, you know, the infrastructure and things like that. Thank you, Sean. So before we leave, let's go ahead and do our myth of the day.
Okay.
All right. So today's myth is that anybody in the U.S. that speaks, that is deaf, speaks ASL. So that's universal in the U.S. What can you tell us about this myth?
Yeah, it's what I get all the time. And I'm like, oh, I wish it was, you know. ASL, like English, is used in many parts of the world, yes, because it is, you know, America is the world's power, so to speak, and that kind of projects throughout the world. But no, ASL is used mostly in America. It's used in Canada, some in other countries. But like even in Puerto Rico, where they do use American Sign Language, they have different dialects to the point where it's really tough for me to understand someone from Puerto Rico, even though it is American Sign Language, because they have different signs for different things. You know, it's a dialect I'm not as familiar with. So ASL is not universal. Sign language is not universal. As much as we want it to be, it's not. There's different dialects, even within the United States. There's different parts of the country. They sign different things. And, you know, even the word for hospital, I've seen 5 to 10 different signs for it based on wherever a person is from in the country. So I wish it was universal, but it is not universal.
Yes. And in the United States, we have, you know, the Black Sign Language, mm-hmm. which the Black community speaks. So how do you, what would be the best practice, you know, if, you mm-hmm. know, we only have ASL interpreters, right? And then comes somebody that, you know, happens to be Mexican Sign Language or Black yeah. or England Sign Language, mm-hmm. And you don't have the interpreter. So how do you, you know, work with that?
Yeah, those are always tough cases because the chances of you having a British Sign Language, a Russian Sign Language, a Mexican Sign Language interpreter in your area, it's going to be challenging. You know, another one that's come up, like in South Florida, is Cuban Sign Language. They have their own sign language. And so they have to have someone who can use that language. For us, whenever we encounter someone like that, we go ahead and employ a certified deaf interpreter. And that is an actual person who is deaf, but is trained as an interpreter to work with cases like this, where a person is from another country, they have a different sign system. And between the two of them, they work together to negotiate a new, almost language, and they communicate, and then they relate. The deaf interpreter relays that information to me as the ASL interpreter. And then I convey that information to the provider. And it's kind of almost a relay system, right? But it's an excellent way to work with someone from other countries. And we've had that happen. You know, maybe a family member, maybe some families have moved, like, for example, from Ukraine, and their parents are deaf and they're older. So they use the Ukrainian Sign Language. I don't know Ukrainian Sign Language. So we have to use a deaf interpreter. And we try to work with the patient. And then we set up a communication with the providers and everyone else involved.
I love that. I didn't know that. That just blew my mind. Because what I was thinking was, okay, so let's go for the example of, you know, deaf Ukrainian, right? So we have,
yes.
let's say the spouse speaks, you know, Ukrainian sign language, the other spouse speaks, you know, Ukrainian. So what I was thinking was like, okay, let's find a Ukrainian interpreter, you know, and then just kind of do that relay through the other, like the spoken language. Would that be another, mm-hmm. like a plan B option if we don't have that sign, or really it just wouldn't work as well? We have to get that specialized sign language interpreter.
For most contexts, I would always get the specialized deaf interpreter, the certified deaf interpreter. And in some cases, like you mentioned, maybe the spouse is hearing and speaks Ukrainian, then we probably would want to bring a Ukrainian interpreter too, just for that person. We do use the, if there's a family member or a friend who does communicate with that person, we do try to like pick up quickly, what signs are you using to communicate certain thoughts and ideas? And then that's what helps us to develop that contact language between all the parties involved. So we do try to include the family members and friends who are there with us at that appointment to help us negotiate this, because it is a unique situation.
I love that. Thank you so much. I've learned so much about it, and I'm sure everybody else has as well. So again, thank you so much, Sean. Please make sure you follow Sean on social media, on LinkedIn, and also Hello Interpreters in all the socials. And we're very, humble and glad to have you here teaching us about, you know, your area of expertise. Is there anything else you would like to say before you say goodbye?
No, just follow us and just remember language access is how to find.
Exactly. Thank you so much, everybody. I'm Joanna Tudela, your strategic partner for Language Services in Patient-Centered Care. We'll see you next time.